This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the Pacific over the past week. Coming up, shark nets are in place as New Caledonia's busiest beach reopens for Christmas business. Demand for Pacific health workers is on the rise in Australia, and concerns raised over the rising rate of homelessness among the Marshallese community in the US. We'll have more on those stories coming up. But first, Bougainville's Attorney General has labelled the Australian government cowardly over its stance on the island's desire for independence from Papua New Guinea. Ezekiel Massat made the comment after Australia's Prime Minister said the issue of the autonomous region's independence is a matter for PNG. A former Australian High Commissioner to PNG says it's a misunderstanding that points to a bigger issue for Bougainville, PNG, and the rest of the region as well. Liam Fox with this report.
It's this statement by Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese last week that has Bougainville's Attorney General Ezekiel Massat fired up. Standing beside his PNG counterpart James Marape after the two leaders signed a wide-ranging security agreement, Mr. Albanese was asked if PNG should respect the outcome of the 2019 Bougainville referendum and grant the region independence.
Well, I'll say very clearly, I respect PNG's sovereignty, and those issues are a matter for Papua New Guinea.
I got mad that the Prime Minister of Australia can stand next to the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea and tell him, no, that's an internal matter for you. You have all the rights and whatever you, how you want to deal with the Bougainville issue.
Mr. Massat didn't just get mad. He's labelled Australia a coward for its stance on the region's independence.
To continue to say, oh, Mivlan Yitrole, and I have responsibility for Papua New Guinea, that's nonsense. That's total nonsense. And that's why I'm accusing Australia of being a coward.
He believes no one, no country, especially Australia, can remain neutral on the issue after 97.7% of eligible Bougainvillians voted in support of independence from PNG.
Everybody must now get up and say, this is the wish of the people. If they want independence, all of us who are witnesses to the peace agreement must then work towards implementing the referendum results.
The referendum is a key part of the Bougainville peace agreement that ended the bloody, decade-long civil war with PNG in the 1990s. Another key part of the agreement is that it is up to PNG's parliament to ratify the referendum result and thereby grant Bougainville independence. Like many others in Bougainville, Mr. Massat believes that is a foregone conclusion, and that Australia and other countries that helped broker the peace agreement should share that view, even though the referendum is non-binding.
Instead of holding Papua New Guinea accountable, Australia gets up and comes up with this nonsense that it's a sovereign matter. No, it's not a sovereign matter. You international players better come on board and exercise your responsibilities.
But not everyone agrees. Ian Kemish is a former Australian High Commissioner to PNG and says Mr. Albanese's statement and the Australian government's approach is appropriate.
I think we should be being the best of friends, but we can't step beyond that. We did provide this country with independence in 1975, and we need to remember that.
Mr. Kemish believes the Attorney General's criticism is due to a misunderstanding about what the Australian government means when it says the issue is a matter for Papua New Guinea.
When Australian ministers, and in this case the Prime Minister, speak about this being a matter for Papua New Guinea, they're seeking to show respect to Papua New Guinea, which includes Bougainville. When heard by some within the autonomous government of Bougainville, they think of Papua New Guinea as the other party in an ongoing dispute.
Mr. Massat also criticised the security agreement signed by the Australian and Papua New Guinean governments last week. Driven by Australia, the agreement is widely seen as an attempt to counter China's influence in the region, but he sees a different motive.
Australia and Papua New Guinea are preparing themselves for the day when the national parliament will say no to the independence vote. And there might be trouble. And then through that security treaty, that provisions will be invoked to quell any potential uprising.
Mr. Kemish says that's nonsense.
The notion that our new bilateral defence agreement with Papua New Guinea is about Bougainville is palpably not true. We all understand what it's actually about, and it's not Bougainville.
He believes Mr. Massat's anger towards Australia highlights a bigger issue for the region. What happens if PNG does not ratify the Bougainville referendum result?
It may well be, most people would say it's most likely, that the vote for independence will be voted down by the National Parliament of Papua New Guinea, and we'll all be needing to find a plan B.
Former Australian High Commissioner to PNG, Ian Kemish, ending that report from Liam Fox. The busiest beach in Noumea has finally reopened for swimming following the installation of a shark net stretching over 750 metres. The beach in New Caledonia's capital has been closed for months following a spate of shark attacks, one of which proved fatal. And while the closure remained in force, tour operators like Alfred Nauka struggled, so he's relieved to see the beach packed with tourists once again.
Everybody was hungry for swimming, so since it has been open, it was just like the flies in the sea. And even the cruises, we were here. I mean, the cruise was here, and everybody was just doing all the shuttles to the beaches. And yeah, it was very, very busy, the beach here.
What does it look like, the shark net? Is it noticeable? Is it ugly?
Well, the shark net is really noticeable. It's not like the ones you have in Australia, New Zealand. This one is really noticeable from far away, yeah. And it, which is makes people think like, yeah, they're safe around there. But since they were swimming, the sharks are still getting around from the nets.
Is that right? There's been sightings of sharks even still. Is that right?
Yeah. There were a couple of sharks around also, yeah. But otherwise, they're safe inside, yeah. We really feel like it took out a big burden from us, yeah. Now most of us are doing the shuttles to the beaches. We're starting to get more and more income. For me, by myself, I mean, I really find it very difficult to pay all the bills and all that. So it was a very, very hard time. So it will be a big thing for us starting from these days and go onward. So by Christmas, we have a lot of cruises coming. So hopefully all the cruises, they will be looking to book again for all these types of tours that we're doing for the waters. And it's a big thing for us. So we're happy. We're happy that the government has done all of this for us here.
Has there been much opposition to these nets from an environmental standpoint?
Yes. There's quite a bit of opposition from that, from the local indigenous. But otherwise, the government has decided all this, so they have to do what they want to, you know. The local indigenous, they try to stop all that, you know, because they think that the sharks is something like, it's natural to them. And it's a nature, so they can't separate people from that. So otherwise, the government didn't listen to them, so it has to do what they want.
And do you know if there are plans to install more shark nets in and around Noumea?
Yes, looking at the Lemon Bay, now they're looking at installing more shark net at the Anzavata. So that's where the big bay is, and that's where the shark attacks took place. So they're looking at the Meridian and Chateau Royal and all the way down to the Dark Island. So they're looking at installing the shark nets there out there. So we're looking forward to all this development.
Alfred Nauka, a tour operator in New Caledonia, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Kyle Evans. A disability provider in Australia's biggest city say there's a growing demand for Pacific Island carers, but there aren't enough to go around. About 1 in 6 people in Australia live with a disability, but those figures aren't broken down by ethnicity. However, as Marion Farr reports, those who work in the industry say there's a desperate need for culturally appropriate care.
Akasita Havili's passion for caring started at a young age.
I am from Tonga. I am a Tongan.
She grew up with 12 siblings in a household where money was tight.
I love helping my parents. I help them with all the things they did.
When she left Tonga to move to Australia in 1982, she carried the value of caring with her. It led her to become a registered nurse. And then in 2021, she started her own business, providing disability and aged care support to people in Sydney.
I have that loving to help others, and that's why I decided this is a good one for me to help the disabilities.
Her business, Nana Cares, has been growing rapidly.
The support that we're giving, the care, the love, you know, it's like a family.
Akasita's daughter, Liberty Pakalani, is the general manager. She says there is increasing demand for carers from Pacific backgrounds.
It's a common theme that's occurring at the moment with all the clients that I'm onboarding. Most of them are not from Pacifica heritage, but they request Pacifica Island carers.
One of those clients is a woman named Anna, who receives support through Australia's National Disability Insurance Scheme.
I've had back injuries. I was hit by a car quite a few years ago, so obviously it has just become worse over the year.
She says connecting with a Pacific Islander support worker has made a huge difference to her life.
I feel very comfortable when she's around. She always comes in with a smile on her face. You know, she's a happy, just a very happy person. She makes you feel good. And it's so important because, you know, it gets you down when you're in pain every single day. Your morale falls down. You just feel down. But when they come in, it lifts you up, you know, spiritually.
Anna says she's formed a close bond with her support worker.
We'll sit down, we'll chat, and, you know, she always makes me laugh. We work together. I always try and help, do the best I can to help. And, you know, as I said, she's never been judgmental, critical.
She'd like to see more Pacific people working in the disability space.
I feel accepted. They've accepted me for who I am. And that is so important.
Liberty Pakalani says it's important for Pacific Islander clients also to have culturally appropriate care.
So that's where you've got someone that understands that, you know, on Sundays we want to go to church. So you've got carers that understand the language, that can explain, you know, can have that conversation with whether it's the elderly or with a disabled person that doesn't really, you know, understand English. They can speak their language. They understand their culture. They enjoy cooking the food that they eat.
But she says meeting the demand for Pacific support workers in Australia has been tough.
There is just a shortage at the moment because a lot of them, you know, when they come from the islands, it's mainly part of the, you know, the seasonal worker program where they're put out into the farms and picking fruit and whatnot.
She wants to see improved pathways for Pacific people to come to Australia and work in the disability space.
There's a requirement, you know, if you get a visa to come over to Australia and work as a carer, you need to have, you know, Certificate 3 minimum. If the government could somehow fund, you know, a Certificate 3 individual support online for people of Pacific background, then they would be able to, you know, do that certificate online, be successful in attaining that certificate, getting a visa, coming over to Australia and working as a carer, and then furthering their studies while they're here and earning an income.
But she also wants to improve awareness among Pacific Islanders living in Australia about their rights and entitlements.
And especially with the elderly as well, when they get elderly, the children feel like it's an obligation that one of the children have to stop working and, you know, just be on a carer allowance or something and look after them. They're not aware of all the wonderful benefits the government has with, you know, the NDIS program or the aged care program, that they're able to have that extra support.
That's something she'd like to see change.
It's baby steps for us to try and go out there and help educate, but where we can or whatever community programs that the Pacifica has, I always try and get involved.
Liberty Pakalani from Nana Cares, ending that report from Marion Farr. The Pacific Island nations and territories have a terrible record on obesity, and the government of New Caledonia has become the latest in the region to introduce taxes on sugar. In future, there'll be additional levies on soft drinks and food with high sugar content. And as Dubravka Volodya reports, the aim is to encourage consumers to consider healthy alternatives in their diets.
It's the sweet taste that draws many people to soft drinks. But that's also a problem, as they contain a fair bit of sugar. In fact, they're seen as one of the key drivers of obesity and are linked to diseases such as diabetes. To encourage its people to cut down on sugar, New Caledonia introduced a sugar tax late last month.
One of the first objective is to help people to contribute less of consuming sugar. I think that everybody knows about the sugar consequences, as many people now died, many people got sick with a diabetic. I think that was very important that the government set up a sugar tax.
Charles Weir works closely with the territory's president. The tax will be slapped on sugar in drinks, but also in foods containing sugar.
It will be affected different products like juice, like some of the consumption that contains the sugar, also like beers and also some of the other products.
He hopes the increased cost will encourage consumers to consider healthier alternatives. The World Health Organization ranks Pacific Island countries among some of the world's most obese nations, and rates of non-communicable diseases often linked to sugar consumption, such as diabetes and heart problems, are also high. To curb the trend, some other Pacific nations introduced sugar taxes a few years ago. Dr. Andrea Tang from New Zealand's Otago University says the world can learn a lot from Pacific countries when it comes to sugar taxes.
When we looked at that, there was actually 16 of 21 Pacific Island countries and territories that had a sugary drinks tax. So that's about three quarters of those countries in the region, which is quite high. And about 14 of those countries had a tax over 20%. So that's the level recommended by WHO if we want to improve health and reduce consumption of these unhealthy drinks.
She says while most nations tax sugary drinks, some also tax sweetened food.
We did a review of taxes on unhealthy food in the Pacific region, and there were at least four or five countries that had an excise tax on unhealthy food. So places like Tonga, Samoa, French Polynesia and Vanuatu have brought in taxes on unhealthy foods, and that includes things like sugary foods and fatty cuts of meat and things like that, which we know are associated with poor health.
A doctor from Vanuatu, Vincent Atua, says his country's sugar tax is a step in the right direction, but there's more space for promoting healthy habits.
It does require a lot more awareness around sugar drinks or diabetes in general and the dangers of diabetes. It remains to be seen whether it will be as effective as it would like it to be. I've certainly seen for similar taxes on cigarettes that it has had some deterring effects because of the huge increase in the prices. So I'm hoping that will be similar for the sugar tax. But I personally haven't really seen that much of a change, and I think it will also come down to choices.
Dr. Atua says in many cases the cost of soft drinks have not increased so substantially that they would trigger a behavior change.
An example would be a can of Coke at one point was 120 vatu. And so more recently, you're buying them for 150 vatu. So it's like 30 vatu difference. And so it's not big enough to really make people change behavior that much. Maybe those who have lower incomes, but to people who are actually working and have a regular income, I'm not sure that it's causing much dissuasion.
Dr. Atua, who's currently working in the hospital emergency department in Nauru, says diabetes is also a huge issue there, despite a sugar tax.
Every day we're seeing patients with complications of diabetes, so it's a worry, big concern. And the government's really trying its best. Nice programs in public health that target people with NCDs. They also, unfortunately, don't have a big agriculture space to grow their own vegetables. So a lot of vegetables have to be imported. And often they're out of the price range of the normal everyday people. So they have huge challenges here in trying to promote healthy diets and lifestyle.
A professor of public health nutrition at Sydney University, Tim Gill, says while data is limited, there are some indications that the tax is linked to people consuming less sugar.
We don't have a huge amount of data on which to evaluate how effective these strategies have been. We do have some data from Fiji that has shown since they imposed their sugar sweetened beverage tax, we've seen quite a significant drop away in the consumption of sugar sweetened beverages and a swap towards bottled water.
He says there is good data from some other countries, such as Mexico, where sugar consumption dropped by about 20% after the introduction of similar taxes. But it's unclear as of yet how big of a long-term impact the sugar tax will have on the high rates of obesity and diabetes. And with some food and drink manufacturers replacing sugar with some unhealthy artificial sweeteners, it's seen by many as a race against time.
A community organization in the United States has helped over 800 Marshall Islanders with their accommodation costs since 2019. But now that the U.S. government funding has dried up, the organization based in Arkansas is noticing a rising rate of homelessness in the community. Marianne Farr spoke with the Marshallese Education Initiative Programs Manager, Marcina Lindgren, about the issue.
Back in 2019, the nonprofit that I work for, we actually had the opportunity to assist the Marshallese community with rental assistance. And it was a $400,000 grant, and the purpose of that grant was to prevent homelessness. And so from 2019 to 2022, we were able to help over 800 individuals or Marshallese families from being homeless or being out on the streets. So now that that program has ended, it's actually still a great need. We still get numerous of calls to the office asking if we are still assisting with rental assistance. And so what I've noticed, you know, the past year or so, or what our organization and the community has noticed, is a very high increase of Marshallese families who have become homeless.
And so how did the community kind of rally around and help this group of people?
When our organization had, you know, partnered up with community organizations, we held a homelessness drive. We collected blankets, toiletries, clothing, anything that the, when we had went to the camps, I personally had thought that there was only, you know, 6 individuals. But when we had actually done a count, there was more than 15. I was at loss for words.
And Marcina, you mentioned the camps. What sort of conditions is this group of people living in?
Here in Springdale, there is a U-Haul company. And so the U-Haul is actually like moving trucks where people can rent and or storage units. And they're actually located behind these storage units. And these camps, you know, they're honestly just tents and a bunch of tarps put together. But they made it to where it's like just a little cute neighborhood for them.
And I know that it's coming into winter in the United States, and it's starting to get really cold. Why is that concerning for this group of people?
I mean, with the winter coming, especially in Arkansas, it gets super bad. It can get below 10 degrees Fahrenheit, there's a lot of ice storms, or, you know, it can rain as well. It rains a lot, and it'll rain and then it freezes over.
Marshallese Education Initiative Programs Manager Marcina Lindgren speaking there with the ABC's Marianne Farr. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific. Pacific Review was produced on the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.